This week on the BOAG World Show, we're talking to Sandip Amlani from Cisco. We talk about the challenges of being user-centric while trying to cater for the unique characteristics of individual country cultures. This week's show is supported by sponsors Full Story and Balsamic. Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG and joining me on this week's show is the very lovely Marcus Lillington. Hello Marcus.
Oh, that's nice, very lovely Paul BOAG.
Well, we're just both very lovely. What can we say about it?
Yeah. We go, it's the sun is shining. It's a bit hot in here, actually. I'm at the office today and this room gets really hot.
Yeah, it does.
So I'm quite pleased that we're only doing kind of half shows and separate interviews these days because it doesn't take as long.
I know, right? It's good. So, yes, I know what you mean about the office getting very hot. I'm a little bit worried about that with the house that we've been renovating our house. I might have got a bit carried away with the windows. There are a lot of windows.
I see. And have you got on all kind of, what are they called, with the houses where everything's sealed? As well, you get like extra points, and the electricity grid gives you money back, and all this kind of thing.
We haven't gone that far, no.
Okay,
but fortunately, although we do have a lot of windows, we do have bifold doors that open up, so my office can get a through draft. One hopes.
fortunately, you're not a big kind of paper person, are you?
No. I don't do paper.
Every time I do that, when it gets really hot at home, fortunately my office at home is it's cool most of the time, but sometimes it gets really hot and I'll open the window and then I'll pop out for a cup of tea, come back in, and there's 100 bits of paper all around the room, stuck to the walls, ceilings.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, no. And but unfortunately mine, we don't get a lot of wind full stop in our garden. So it's going to be an oven. I've made a horrible mistake, Marcus. There is no going back at this point. We're moving in a matter of weeks, and I've just suddenly realised I've designed a greenhouse.
Yeah, and moving in June, just ready for the really hot spell.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
You'll both be really miserable because you'll think you've made a dreadful mistake. But even though 10 months of the year, it'll be really nice.
That'd be fine. It's going to be fine. It's all fine. It's fine. It's fine.
How long ago did you move out? It seems like years.
March.
Oh, not
last that. Year.
Oh, last year.
No, I don't know. Do you know, I honestly don't remember. I've blocked it from my... I think we're going to be out... We'll have been out 8 months.
That's a long time.
It is a long time, but they've done shit loads.
Yeah.
I'll be glad to be back in.
I like watching programmes like Grand Designs and things, but then I think I couldn't actually do it. You know, you see them going gradually madder and madder and sort of killing people. I would actually kill people and go mad completely.
Mm-hmm. I have done. there's no way around it. I have emotional problems now. Although I did
what
before.
What do you mean now? So that's,
yeah, exactly. Anyway... Let's talk about your thought for the day, Marcus. I like this bit. It's good because we start the show and then I can sit back and do nothing while you talk.
That's fine. This week's one is actually more like a thought for the day. It's sort of along those kind of lines rather than me just rehashing an old blog post. I've talked about this on the show before many times because it's something that I'm quite good at, about trying not to worry and staying positive and stuff like that. Kind of relevant.
That's very relevant. A to me at the moment, but also B that as we're recording this, it's Mental Health Week.
It is indeed Mental Health Awareness Week. We know this very well because Headscape works for the Mental Health Foundation.
Oh, do you really? I didn't know that.
Little plug. There you go. Yeah, we did their site 3 years ago, something like that.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So yes, that's a tangent. It's completely thrown me.
Sorry.
That's okay. Staying positive and not worrying too much is something I'm pretty good at. So I kind of occasionally sort of think about why that could be, and I thought I'd share that. It's particularly relevant for us at the moment at Headscape because the first time in 3 years, we've got a bit of a kind of lull in the proceedings. We're finishing off some stuff, but there's a bit of a gap before we think things are going to pick up again. So that's
okay.
That's always for someone in your position, someone in my position, something that means it can bring on the worries. Fortunately for us, our medium term pipeline's good, looking good, but you know, you never know. But I think the advice is don't get too hung up on targets or plans or deadlines. Almost to a certain extent, lie to yourself. It's true, though. It's kind of true. It's about, I think that the real problem, the reason why people get they over worry is because they worry too much, is because they overanalyze, and that creates this kind of cycle of stagnation. That you keep going over things, you keep going over things, and you might come up with a different conclusion about something, but then you'll worry about that conclusion, and is it right? And actually just kind of get on with it is my...
Really? Yeah. Really? This is your advice for not worrying. As someone that worries quite a lot, I just want to give you a slap at this point.
That was the wrong choice of words. Getting on with something is better than psychically overanalyzing.
Yeah,
that's,
I agree with
that's that. That's what I mean.
That overanalyzing thing is a huge thing. It's really funny. Literally just today, I've posted a post going, how to overcome analysis paralysis. But it's about web design, not about running your own business. Because it is true. It goes round and round and round and round in your head. It's horrible.
But this isn't just about running your own business. This is about everything you do in your life. Some people overanalyze everything. They overanalyze their relationships, et cetera, et cetera. And then those relationships, in my limited viewpoint, often fall apart. So it's just kind of try and... I'm not going to use words at that point because I'll end up sounding flippant again. You get the point. Thing that really works for me is write stuff down. Even if it's just lists of things, because they're really easy to do and they give you this ability to kind of like get to the edges of something, because often you'll be worrying because, oh, it's too big for me to think about and I can't encompass everything. But if you write it all down, it might be a list of 20 things, and then you go, that's all of it, so I can see the edges of it. That's a good idea. But also just the act of writing it down, I think, is cathartic. It is for me, anyway.
I agree.
And from a kind of business point of view, what we need to do now, I mean, we're still finishing other stuff off, but is to use this downtime, which we haven't had any of for 3 years, to do some interesting, enjoyable stuff. And yes, we will be redesigning the Headscape site, finally, which is excellent.
I don't believe you.
All right. There is a new design, but whether it gets built or not, or this... I lie. There's the beginnings of a new design. Oh, dear. But just checking my notes here. The other one, the final point here is that I found, again, this works for me, might not work for everybody, is just to kind of do random stuff occasionally. Obviously, not all the time, but, you're good at this. You go... You know what? I'm going to go and just walk down to the river, and I might even work from the cafe and that kind of thing, rather than just staying in the same place every day doing your monotonous job or whatever. Change stuff, basically. Go out for lunch. Mm. Why not? Spend some money. And that's it, really. That's my thought.
I think that's very good. That last piece of advice in particular is a really good one. And even if it's changing what you were working on. It's like, at the moment, I've got too much stuff on at the moment.
Yeah.
And, I planned it out and I worried about it because I've got too much stuff on. And then you become like paralyzed. You sit down to do whatever it was that you were supposed to be doing. And it's like, oh, I can't do it. So I just go and work on something else, even if it's not as urgent, because it's better to work on something than it is nothing at all.
I'm exactly the same. When there's too much on, I do all the things I like doing first. And then, and then the pile of stuff that I don't want to do just becomes, it's like nagging me away at me. You're there at the moment, aren't you?
Well, no, I find a different, it has a different response with me. So I start doing this stuff, the things I like, and then I build momentum and it gets me going.
Ah, right, yeah.
And then I feel able to do the more complicated stuff. Today was a great example of this. So I've got to, I've got feedback on a draft that I've written for a course for Shopify. I always want to say Spotify every time. So I'm writing this course for Shopify, and they've given me a load of feedback on what I've written, and I looked at it, and it was like just pages of comments. And you go, I've lost the will to live. But by going and doing, I wrote my newsletter instead, I got some momentum going, and actually it wasn't that bad when I looked at it. And which goes back to that other point about defining the edges, isn't it?
Yeah,
that, you know,
absolutely.
Things get bigger in your head.
Red pen always looks worse, doesn't it? Whether it's red,
it does.
You know, red anything, it's like, ooh, they hate me as well.
Yeah, and you also feel inadequate. Oh no, I'm a really shit writer. I don't know what I'm talking about. Yeah,
yeah, all those things.
Yeah, so I turn that into raging anger, where I deeply resent them and write lots of passive aggressive emails back.
But that you never send.
That I never send them. Though, obviously, it's all internalized. So Shopify, if you're listening to this right now, I do deeply hate you.
There you go. It's out there in the world.
It is. I've said it. So you're already struggling to come up with subjects for the thought for the day. Is that why you had to go kind of airy fairy?
Oh no. I thought I'd just do something a bit different.
Just mix it up.
Mm-hmm.
There is a place that you can look now for inspiration, which is that every day in the Slack channel, have you seen this? I'm asking a question.
Yeah, it does make me laugh. This is Paul's way of dealing with the Slack channel while he's got too much work on.
shut up.
put one question up in the morning and let them run. I responded to it this morning, Paul, twice.
Did you?
Yes.
I don't know. I haven't looked at it. I've been too busy.
You proved my point.
Exactly. Now, you know me far too well. But it's worked really well, hasn't it?
Yeah,
people have really got loads of people that don't normally post have posted. And I was thinking, I bet there's some really good answers in there that you could use.
Ian's one was the best one. Our Ian at Headscape. He wants you to ask the question, what's everyone having for dinner tonight?
I don't know. Why did he want that answered?
For inspiration.
Okay. My questions have been far more useful. Anyway, if you want to join the Slack channel, you could do so by going to boagworld.com/slacking, and you too can find out what Ian's having for dinner.
If you ask the question.
Yeah, which I haven't yet asked. Anyway, should we talk about our first sponsor of the day, and then we'll talk about who our interview is.
Who's so our first sponsor of the day, Paul?
Guess. It's always the same two people. So, yeah, which one am I going to do first?
Is it Balsamic this week? Or a Full Story?
No, Full Story are first this week.
Okay.
Yeah.
There you go.
So, it's so nice to have long-term sponsors. I really like it. It's great. You get to know them. I chat with them a lot. I get to know their product better so I can become more confident in recommending them.
Cool.
Or, alternatively, I discover it's shite. It could go either way. Fortunately, with Balsamic and Full Story, it hasn't gone that way. I still love them as much as I always did. Full Story, let's talk about that. So Full Story is a session recorder. And you might be wondering why you need the ability to replay sessions, to be able to watch user sessions. We've got so many great tools in our arsenal as designers that give us a kind of broad idea of what's going on with our product. We've got analytics, and we've got social media monitoring, and we've got all these fancy tools, but nothing beats that kind of visceral personal understanding that's given from watching real users interacting with your pages in real time. It's so much more human than analytics are. And you can see those nuances of behavior that I think is so great. And although I'm a huge fan of usability testing and it's something that I encourage people to be doing all of the time, as soon as you bring someone in and they know they're being watched, then immediately they start behaving differently. While with a session recorder, you can watch people doing their thing on the website completely unobserved, that they behave completely naturally. And yes, I know it all sounds a bit creepy, but it's all like anonymized and you can't see anything important like password information or anything like that. You're only seeing how they move around the site and they interact with the site. And it's just so invaluable for proving the experience. There's no, you can't use it in any kind of dodgy way. It's just, it just gives you insights into to how people behave, and it helps uncover those UX problems and general design issues that you can't suss out from like analytics or interviews or that kind of stuff. So that's why session recorders. But why Full Story? Well, because Full Story offers the highest fidelity session replay that you can get, basically, because it indexes every single event on a page, right? So you can search every action, every part. You can see when a user furiously rage clicks a button, for example, or instantly view any person that has, you know, got frustrated with the site and, you know, failed to get it to interact. You can also get insights that are invaluable and endless. It gives you kind of data on all of this stuff as well. So it's that huge balance between the kind of data and being able to watch those sessions back. You can sign up for a free month of their pro account. No need to enter a credit card or anything like that. And if you don't feel that you want to sign up for their or keep going with their pro account, that's absolutely fine. You can continue for free up to 1,000 sessions per month, which is a really great deal. So you can find out more about that by going to fullstory.com/Boag. So this week, so what we had so far, we've had episode 1, Virgin Atlantic, mm-hmm. episode 2, the University of Dundee. So in my continual search for random companies that are as different as possible from one another.
A broad spectrum,
that's the word, rather random.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're not random.
It sounds like you meant it then, if it's a broad spectrum.
It does. And I did actually. I went out of my way to get a broad spectrum. So this week we've got Cisco. As the company that we're chatting with, and a lovely gentleman that I met called Sandip. And so really fascinating, because Cisco are in a very different place again. They're a huge, huge multinational company that spans the globe. You know, can you imagine the kind of problems and challenges that presents in creating a great user experience, let alone building a user-centric culture across that organization. And Sandip is kind of at the nexus of that in many ways, because he kind of sits between global, you know, which do all of the kind of main strategy stuff, and then the individual countries and regions, right? So he's trying to create a unified experience and translate what has been created at the global level for a more regional level. And it's an amazing challenge that he faces. So let's jump into the interview with him and see how he's getting on. Sandip, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's very much appreciated. I was thinking maybe a good place for us to start is you telling us all a little bit about your role and what it is that you do at Cisco.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for inviting me on this. So my role at Cisco is very much about the on-site experience on cisco.com across EMEA. My actual job title is Cisco.com manager for EMEA. It's a strategic role. It covers SEO, conversion rate optimization, user experience, and publishing across the 40 or so European Cisco.com websites. I work very closely with the global team, because the spine of the Cisco.com site is very much pushed out from the global team, and that is how the site was initially set up. So we have a global SEO team, a global UX team, and we lean on them very heavily for rolling out capabilities across region. But we also work very closely with like the country teams, so providing design best practices and setting up processes, and providing them with education as well. So giving them the means and knowledge and the expertise to actually to build out journeys pages for themselves. And we work very closely with the campaign teams as well. So when we have new campaigns, quite often these campaigns will come down from global. So currently have like an SMB campaign, for example. That's a real focus for us, because we want to really show SMBs that, you know, Cisco's not just about enterprise level customers that we're after. It's really the SMBs, the smaller companies really can find value in what we can provide. So those campaigns will come down from global, and we would then adapt them. We have omni-channel managers that will adapt those for the touchpoint strategies and roll those out across the European websites. That's it in a nutshell.
Wow. Cool. I mean, you know, Cisco is obviously a huge organization, and also has been around for a very long time. And so I'm kind of quite interested in what the culture is in relationship to user experience, because, you know, you often find that, you know, the bigger a company, the longer it's been around, the more challenges there are about, you know, having a very user-centric culture. Has that been a challenge at Cisco?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Cisco's been around since the early 80s. So, you know, long before those, you know, the digital era ushered in companies like, you know, Facebook and Amazon and Google. And part of the issue that a company like Cisco has is, you know, those kind of companies that came around in the digital age were, they have certain characteristics that are inherent within what they do. So, you know, collaboration and working in an agile way, failing fast, iterating, building, testing, all of those things that inherent what they do is stuff that we've had to retrofit into the processes that we have at Cisco. And that's not been easy, it's got to be said.
So tell me some of the challenges maybe that you've faced around that, because, you know, I there will be a lot of people that are listening to this. They might not work in a company of the size of Cisco, but they understand what you mean in terms of retrofitting. So you're kind of not alone in this. So I'm kind of interested in maybe some of the challenges, the specific challenges that you face.
Okay, so I guess a key one, I guess this is something that, you know, people in many big companies will really resonate with them is you know, teams working in silos. So, you know, they've got their own objectives, they get very fixated on their own KPIs in their area. And quite often those KPIs and those objectives that they have within their specific silo, within their department, it doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily aligned with the broader picture that the company is trying to achieve. And so this is a point where you need to start challenging things and say, okay, so, you know, you work in marketing, your KPI is to increase engagement points, or is to increase the number of form fills that you have. But actually, is that the best thing for the customer? Are we going to gate all our pieces of content just so that you can hit your KPIs of increasing form fills? And these are things that do need to be challenged. And it does mean that what's previously been in place, the status quo that they've always worked against, that's not necessarily the best thing for the customer, and therefore it's not necessarily the best thing for the company. And those things, you do need to sometimes chip away at it for a company that's been around for 30-odd years and that's always done things in a certain way. The way that we do this, the way that I've certainly done this, is to be much more data-driven. So really just looking at the numbers, looking at the proof in terms of like the analytics that we have, even things like the NPS score, how people actually feel about Cisco as a company, those are things that, you know, we can move a needle on just by being much more customer centric.
So, I mean, do you find that actually, you talked about KPIs there and how individual silos or departments or regions are measured. Do you think sometimes Cisco is measuring the wrong KPIs, that then those KPIs are not customer centric focused enough? And is that a kind of a senior leadership problem, or are you getting the right kind of message from the top?
We're certainly getting the right kind of message from the top. One of the things that I've only been at Cisco for about 15 months or so, but one of the things that I've noticed about this company is that it's always willing to listen. So if anyone at any level pushes back and challenges you know, ways that we've been doing things in the past, then senior leadership are willing to listen. And the form fill side of it was something that we've been dealing with recently. And actually, for our most recent campaign around SMBs, we've not gated any content whatsoever because, you know, there has to be a fair value exchange as to, you know, when you're asking for someone's email, what are they getting back in return? Is it something they can get elsewhere? Are we providing ultimately the best experience for them? And the example that we've used internally is around, for example, if you're buying a pair of trainers, you might go to the Nike website and you might look at all of the specs. You might look at all of the, you know, all the technical stuff around around the trainers. But when it comes to actually buying those trainers, it's not, you know, they may have like a, you know, e-commerce functionality on the Nike website, but people then generally tend to go off elsewhere. And that's a very similar story for Cisco in that people normally pick up the phone and talk to their account manager in their partner. And, you know, not as much would come through the Cisco site directly. So if that's the case, why are we, you know, making it difficult for our users to find the content and information that, that they need in order to make a decision, which ultimately affects the company in a good way, if they, even if they go off to a partner to then buy their kit.
So, I mean, one of the things that I find quite interesting about huge companies like Cisco, and you've kind of already touched on this, is you've got a central global function, you know, a central UX team, yet you're a multinational company and you're dealing with this range of cultures and languages that all impact how you go about approaching and creating a great, good user experience. Is that an area that you found challenging? Is the global team aware enough of all those cultural nuances? Because that's a really hard challenge for any single team to be able to approach.
Absolutely, yeah. And we're probably about halfway through a five-year digital transformation plan. I mean, digital transformation doesn't end once you get to the end of that 5 years. The key kind of facets of what we're trying to change, we're probably about halfway through that. And that's actually part of the reason why this regional digital team was created, just to get closer to those countries. Because previously everything was done from global. There might be a handful of people at region. There'll be digital marketing managers in country, but everything was actually pushed out from global, and it was then implemented to varying degrees by the countries with a certain level of leadership from region. Now that we have this regional leadership team built out within digital, it certainly helps with things like setting down processes, setting down governance structures, getting closer to those countries that have those nuances, whether it be around around language, around how their visitors read the site, how they use the site, whether they're interested more in products or solutions or case studies. We're much more closer to it now. So it is something that we're dealing with actively. And one of the phrases that I like to use is freedom within the framework. And what I mean by that is that in order to get scale, you do need to have like a centrally managed service to a certain extent. At the same time, you do need to have your services, your offerings, and you know what you're putting out to your visitors locally optimized. It needs to be country relevant, and that's what we're trying to achieve with this. You know what we're now calling regionally led, country relevant model. So in the past, it would have been like a global model. We did dabble with a country centric model, which you know. Clearly became clear that it wasn't scalable to any standard. So actually the middle ground here, the hybrid, is a regionally led, country relevant model. You know, where you may have like 80% of the content on the website is pushed out by global, it's localized by global, but 20% of the content is very much locally focused, local events, things that are much more relevant to those local markets. Yeah, and I just wanted to also mention one of the ways that we achieve this is we have a program called One Voice Web, and that's again it's driven by a global, and it focuses on the top 100 odd pages across the website. We have 89 country websites. They all look the same in terms of structure. They've got similar home pages, you know, top tier pages and secondary pages. And this One Voice Web program allows us to, at scale, update those key pages, whether it's the routers homepage, the switches homepage, the IoT homepage. All of those are managed locally. Whenever there's updates that come out from the product teams, they're updated on those pages, localized and pushed out. And the key challenge with that is that if you try to localize absolutely everything, you're going to end up with a localization bill of like millions and millions of pounds. Mm-hmm. So yeah. we've got around that by depending on the tier of a country. So, you know, the size of the country, the number of visitors, you would get 100% of that One Voice Web program, all 100 pages localized. Beyond that, when you start going to lower tier countries, it might be 80% or 60%. And one of the challenges with that is that you'll end up, say if you're on the Polish site, for example, two or three clicks into the site, you'll then get kicked off to the US site because we don't have a localized version. So, you know, whilst it's understandable why we do that, it's also important that we understand that we treat the customer carefully here and we show them what's going on. They understand what's happening.
I mean, is there, within the individual countries, is there an awareness of the importance of user experience? Is there the skill there, or are you really kind of spoon-feeding them from a regional
level? We're very much spoon-feeding them from a regional level. Yeah, absolutely. It has been a challenge, actually, where UX is I wouldn't say it's a new discipline, generally speaking, but it is something that being driven from global, actually disseminating that education out into region and global it has been quite challenging, but it is something that we're addressing. We're starting to build out user experience expertise within region. We're starting to do a lot more user research in region because, you know, the stuff that happens in the global team out in San Jose, that's not necessarily going to be relevant to people Germany or in the UK or in France. And so the importance of actually having like a UX function by region is very much recognized, and we're starting to address that.
So you're kind of, I'm guessing, at fairly early days in that process. So how are you addressing it? Are you trying to bring people in-house that have got user experience skills, or are you relying on regional agencies? What's the kind of
approach
there?
It's actually a mix of utilizing the global teams. So we've just had like a bit of a reorganization within the UX organization in the US, and there's much more of a focus on actually making sure that in region we are actually building things that make a lot of sense. We've also got things like drop-in clinics for UX. So if someone in region or in country wants to build out a journey or a page, they can actually drop into this UX clinic. They have like office hours for EMEA, office hours for APJ, so it covers the globe. And you can say, right, I'm building this out. We want to put these components on the page. This is the objective of the page. This is what we're trying to do. And we'll get some expertise, from those calls.
Oh, I love that. That sounds like a really interesting idea. Because, you know, so essentially anybody that needs help with UX can get access to that help very, very quickly and quite informally.
So you can just give them a heads up a week beforehand, say, look, this is what I'm trying to do. Let's discuss this on the drop-in clinic next week. And we have the same thing for SEO as well. So we've got the SEO EMEA office hours call. So again, if there's anything that you're trying to do, you can get expertise from the global team. But that said, we do also have local or regional expertise. I've got an SEO manager working for me that's now trying to push the agenda for SEO, which is it's been interesting.
So do you have like training material, or, you know, like self-learning courses or a service manual or anything like that that kind of helps people at that more local level understand what they need to be doing and how they need to be working?
There's a number of forums as well that we have. So within our intranet, we collate all of the training that we've put together, whether it's around UX, SEO, CRO, paid media, whatever it might be, and we put them up on our intranet and make it available to the digital marketing managers across Europe. And not just them as well, but we also have what we call audience experts. They're basically the subject matter experts for each product family. They're the guys that are running the content. So it's really important for them to know about things like SEO, writing SEO-friendly copy. If they have a page, they need to understand the flow of the page and what the objective is. So, you know, having training available to them, we run it on WebEx. Obviously, WebEx is a key product of Cisco, so which is quite useful, obviously. But we then put these recordings up, these WebEx recordings up, on our intranet site, saying, okay, this is what the audience is useful for, this is what the training is, what it contains, and here's a recording for it. Go ahead and just self-serve.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because the drop-in centers are great to some. It's certainly a brilliant idea. I've not heard that one before, and I really love it. But, you know, having that kind of self-service, self-learning stuff is really good as well. So, yeah, really interesting. One of the things that I often – we kind of touched on this earlier, but it's a problem that I often see is this balance between kind of company objectives and company targets and those kinds of things and meeting the needs of users. Do you see that as a conflict point in Cisco? How are you dealing with that kind of relationship between, you know, you've got to remain profitable, you've got targets you've got to meet, but also we don't want to alienate users in this. Where are you at as a company?
I mentioned it in the past when we were talking about the Nike example. So, you know, different teams would have different objectives. Mm. They will often conflict with each other for against the greater good for the company. But I do very much stand by the saying that if you solve customer problems, you will probably end up solving business problems. And what I mean by that, one of your initiatives that I've led recently is around a geo router lightbox that pops up. So a lot of people go to the global site, you know, type in cisco.com, they end up on the global site, even if they're in the UK or France and there's a local site available to them. Also, from an SEO perspective, if they're typing in things and they go to the US site, and there's obviously some SEO work that we need to do to make sure the local sites appear. But the key thing is that 70% of users on the global site are not from the US. So how do we resolve this? How do we actually signpost this? You know, obviously, you can sniff their IP address and present them, recognize where they're coming from, and present them with a lightbox that says, hey, it looks like you're from the UK site. You fancy going to see some local events, products, and services? Click here. Or you can stay on the global site. Now, it was very challenging to get that through, because a lot of resistance around people saying, well, that's very intrusive, it's in your face, it's not very user-friendly. You know, the fact is, if you are a customer or a visitor in France and you go to the global site not aware that there's local content available for you, you'll probably appreciate being told that in a light-touch way. And lightboxes can provide that, you know. You can ignore it. You can click around it. You can stay on the site that you're, stay on the US site. But once you do that, you'll start solving business problems such as, well, we don't get enough traffic on the French site, so we can't run any tests. You know, it's going to take time to get statistical significance. Uh-huh. So, you know, just by solving that, just signposting the right local site for visitors to go to, you start solving business problems.
I mean, going back to this, kind of embedding that user-centric thinking in the company and encouraging that at all levels. It sounds like there's a kind of an established user experience culture at the global level, but maybe not so much at the regional or country levels, or certainly not the country levels. And then you seem to be quite campaign driven in certain ways as well. Are there things that you're doing to encourage more user-centric thinking? I mean, you've mentioned a couple of things in terms of, the self-learning material, the drop-in center, but that kind of requires people to recognize the need for that kind of thing. Is there, you know, are you running any kind of promotional internal comms campaign to raise awareness?
I mean, Cisco does invest quite a lot in things like personas and actually building out really, really detailed personas for all of our types of buyers, whether they be enterprise network buyers or SMB buyers or whatever it might be. And I know there's a tendency in some organizations just to do, you know, commission a really expensive piece of work and then just have it sat in a drawer somewhere. No one's actually using it. You've probably seen that yourself. So, how do we get that learning and put that really in front of people's faces whenever they're working? One of the things that, you know, I'm really pushing for at the moment is actually, you know, to distill these kind of huge documents, 10-page documents about the persona of each persona and what their likes, dislikes, where their watering holes are and everything else, and actually distill that down to something that you can just stick on the wall somewhere. And so that when people are working, where they're like, okay, I'm working on an SMB campaign, this is what I need to make sure we include, that we think about when we're building our journeys. So just to keep it kind of front and foremost in people's minds when they're building out campaigns. But you're right, we can be quite campaign led within Cisco, and then there does need to be a level of always on in terms of when we're creating. One way that we're dealing with that is things like using SEO data to inform content decisions. In the past, Cisco has very much been building things out from a Cisco out perspective. We want to talk about products. We want to talk about this product. But if you've seen the site recently, we've moved away from that and started talking about, you know, how we can help our customers. What pain points do they have? What are their care about? And how Cisco can bridge that. So just by using the SEO data, you're actually using data, you know, for people are actually searching for these things in their own language. And when we've been presenting this to the audience experts and saying, look, maybe you should be writing content about this because, you know, we've got a ton of people searching on this, looking at our search console. And it's like a light bulb.
Yeah.
It's like, right, okay, great. If they're looking for it, I'm going to be writing content for it. You know, fishing in a place where there's fish.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a really good idea. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? A lot of UX people, I think, have quite a negative attitude towards search engine optimization and, you know, you shouldn't design for search engines, you should design for people. And I kind of get that and I understand that point of view. But what you've just described is actually using the data that you get back from that kind of search to discover people's mental models, how they think about things, how they word things, how they talk about things, what they care about, which
we've moved on from spamming the hell out of your site with keywords and SEO is a bit of a fine art now, that it's, you have to write in natural language. You have to write for humans and not for a bots. But there is a balance there as well, that you can still improve your SEO rankings, but not, you know, create content that sounds unnatural.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting. I wrote a post not long ago, which was basically saying how focusing on SEO has helped me improve the user experience of my blog. And it actually did, you know, thinking about the terminology that people use and all of those kinds of things. It's, you know, it's not mutually exclusive anymore, which is great.
I interrupt you, but I know in the distant past, we were very much focused on talking about telepresence, which is our kind of version of video conferencing. The directive was, let's just talk about telepresence and stick telepresence as keywords up on our pages. We'll start, you know, doing paid search campaigns around telepresence. The fact is, no one was searching for the word telepresence. Everyone was searching for the word video conferencing.
Yeah.
So again, light bulb moment. As soon as you turn that around, it's like, okay, people are searching for that. Let's write about that.
Absolutely. You know, it's such a simple thing, isn't it? But it's amazing how, you know, companies, I see it all the time, companies, you know, pushing a name of their product that means nothing to people, you know, and if it's a waste of time. So, I mean, you've been there 15 months, yeah. Did you say? I think you said 15 months. Yeah. So in that time, what do you think the best thing that you've been able to do to make the company more user-centric? What's worked really well?
I mean, the Geo Router Light Box is, in terms of a single initiative, that's been the key one, just because of the resistance on getting that live and actually how it's become something that all countries are getting involved in. And they're like, yeah, okay, let's test this on our side as well. But in terms of things like ongoing processes, we've just recently set up an agile optimization team within EMEA. And this is not something that we've done in the past. It's been kind of like a side job, maybe 5-10% of an analyst's time just to look at a bit of data and understand, where we might have some gaps and then, get the global team to build out a test for us. But we just weren't getting a cadence of tests out there. So, as of the last couple of months, we've just built out this team. We've got the support of an agency as well to not just help with the opportunity identification, the hypothesis, but also with the build and the analysis of those tests. We're also getting a lot more people involved in the optimization process, from audience managers to audience experts and digital marketing managers to analysts, even the developers. The developers have a lot of input into how you can actually design tests. So, when you build an agile optimization team like that, it becomes, testing becomes much more ingrained in the culture of a company as opposed to some side job.
Yeah, which is brilliant, isn't it? So that sounds like a really good. That sounds really exciting. I've got one more question for you, and I'm going to change the question that I gave you in advance. All right, which is sorry. There's nothing like just dropping questions on people on the fly. But I'm quite interested in what do you want to do next? What's the next thing you want to achieve to improve user experience? Or to establish a more user, centric kind of culture?
I think in terms of the way that a company is set up, and I'm thinking quite holistically here, but a lot of companies, you've heard the saying that, nowadays you shouldn't have a digital team. You shouldn't have anyone with the word digital in their title. And that's right to a certain extent. If you work in those companies that were ushered in with the digital era, that makes a lot of sense. But in a company like Cisco, you have to start off with a digital team. You have to have that level of skills and experience and knowledge in one area that you can then disseminate that out across the company. What I'd like to see is a point almost, I'm not doing myself out of the job here, but I'd like to see there not be a digital team, and that digital is actually an inherent part of what everyone does. So that's, I'm talking kind of years ahead, but that's how I see the ultimate goal here.
And I would totally agree with that. It's a progression, isn't it? You need to pass through the stages of centralizing digital in a single team for a while you establish that new culture, that new methodology, that new way of doing things. And then, eventually you want to get to a point where you've really established that culture across the organization where everybody kind of inherently knows how to do it. And at which point, you're right. You're doing yourself out of a job. That those things will happen organically, naturally across the company, and there won't be a need for that. No. But you can't skip one of those stages, can you? You can't just go from complete chaos to suddenly everybody understands and knows digital and what to do with it. So, I think that's a worthy goal, Sam.
Thank you.
You'll have my full support. Carry on. All right. Thank you so much for your time. That was really interesting. It's good to talk to a company that is going through this process, that is in the middle of this transformation. We're trying to speak to kind of a range of different companies in different places. Some people right at the beginning, where everything's a bit of a mess. We've got some, post-digital companies like Uber and people like that obviously have got it baked into their DNA. But to talk to a company that is going through this transformation process is really interesting, because I think that's where a lot of people are at. you know, a lot of people are in that journey. And so it's good to hear your experiences. So thank you very much.
No, thank you.
So there you go, that's Sandip. Marcus, what did you think of that? It was an interesting one, wasn't it?
It was. It's kind of, I just sort of found myself nodding a lot, going, yes, yes. It was kind of like, it was like listening to somebody who's doing all the right things and they're halfway through it. And I didn't really have an awful lot more to say than that, other than the kind of usual observations of massive companies and how I would never want to work at one. It's like all the different, you know, endless jargon and all the different types of people who are all doing the same job. You know, digital managers, analysts, SEO marketing specialists, global this, regional that. And it's like, do they need all these people? But anyway, it was just kind of encouraging to hear that he didn't go, well, we're doing 80% of it's working, but the other 20% we're never going to get a chance at. There was nothing like that.
No, and actually they struck me as quite open to change as a company. You know, I was expecting when I met Sandip for the first time, because they asked me to go in and speak at one of their internal events, and you know, I was expecting to find quite a resistant culture. You just find that with larger organizations, but there isn't really that sense there. I think that their biggest challenge is just that, you know, with an organization that big, it takes a long time to turn the ship. It's not that anyone's debating that the ship needs turning or what direction even to turn. It just takes a long time to do. And that I thought was quite interesting. To, you know, that just because you're a big company doesn't mean everybody is utterly risk averse and, you know, a little bit negative.
Yeah, I mean, all the stuff about having the drop-in clinics, and I'm thinking, well, if they were generally negative and risk averse, then nobody would turn up to them. But obviously they do, because they're still doing them. So I just sort of thought, it's not a very exciting observation, but it's kind of like, well, yeah, they're doing all the right things.
I did like that drop-in clinic idea. I thought that was a really good, because, you know, I've got this tendency to focus on, oh, let's produce a load of, you know, online training material for people. But, you know, which is fine if you're someone like me that's very online orientated, tends to be, you know, like self-learning, but not everyone's like me. You know, there are different people and different people want different things. So a drop-in centre I thought was a brilliant idea. I'm so glad they're doing that.
Particularly for, you know, less digitally savvy people. I mean, I just think people in general, actually, I think most people learn more from another person who's an expert. I think that's...
Really?
Yes, really.
Yeah, see, now that's radically different to me, because I don't like other human beings, and I definitely don't like other human beings who are cleverer than me.
Yeah, but it could be something you know nothing about. Like, I don't know, if you want to learn to play the trombone.
Cricket.
Yeah, well, cricket, no, I just can't imagine that ever happening. But the trombone, I can.
You could imagine me learning the trombone, could you?
Yes, I can. And I think you wouldn't have a problem with a human being trying to teach you that, surely. Over learning about it from YouTube, say.
Do you know what? I would a bit, if I'm being entirely honest, because when you're with another person, you're showing your ignorance, right? I would feel silly. Why don't I get this? Why aren't my hands doing what they're meant to? Why am I so clumsy? Why haven't I picked this up quicker? While with something like YouTube or some self-learning stuff, nobody sees me fail.
Yeah, but you're not always going to get that, you know, the kind of that little knacks of things that somebody can point out. That one thing that you should be doing that you don't know, that you haven't picked up from watching YouTube or whatever, they can just see it instantly and tell you, and you're on to the win.
Well, it's that kind of emphasises the need for a bit of both, doesn't it? Basically,
it does. I just think that I think you're in the minority, but I might be wrong.
I think you're in the minority, so there.
La, 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 la.
La, la, la. I don't care.
Answers on a postcard, people.
So anyway, that was our interview with Sandip from Cisco. And that's going to be particularly interesting, because next week, he says, after going on about his broad spectrum or whatever it was I said, next week we've got IBM. Oh. Now, IBM are obviously in some ways very similar to Cisco, but... much older than Cisco, so I've been around much longer, and a very different cultural situation, but also very different place in terms of where they are on that kind of user experience journey. So the contrast between the two is really quite fascinating, and I think you'll enjoy comparing the two. So let's talk about our second sponsor, which is Balsamiq. Balsamiq, most of us have used Balsamiq at one stage or another in our career, but most of us have used the desktop app because for a long time that's was all that's available, and there's still the desktop app available if you want it. But now Balsamiq is mainly web-based, right, which makes it perfect for collaboration, right? So it's got things like built-in threaded comments with call-outs, and you could do real-time collaboration, and there's even, you know, a chat panel and that kind of thing. So it's really designed for brilliantly for remote teams to be able to work together at the same time on a prototype. So you can have multiple project owners on an individual project, but you can set different permissions. Basically, you can have editors, you can have reviewers, you can even allow public access to a prototype that you're building, which is obviously great, you know. And you have this one link that doesn't change that you can hand out to people, and people can comment on what you're doing, which is really good for opening up to a wider community. Of course, it's still Balsamiq, so it's still easy to learn. Lots of drag and drop and resizing, perfect for your project managers and your CEOs and people that don't use those kind of same digital tools that perhaps we do, or design tools. You could get a 30-day free trial. Go for it. Try it out. See if you like it. You can get that by going to balsamiq.cloud. As a little sweetener, if you then decide you want to sign up for the main account, you can get, you know, for the paid version, you can get 3 months additional for free. So when you go in and add your billing information, you'll see a place for entering a code. If you just enter the code BOAGWORLD, then you'll get your first 3 months of the Balsamiq Cloud absolutely free of charge, which is brilliant. Cool. So that is pretty much it for this show, except obviously for Marcus's joke.
And I need some more jokes, people. I had to go and find this one all by myself. So you have been.
Oh no!
You've been warned. Yeah. two guys sitting in a kayak were chilly, okay? Mm-hmm. But when they lit a fire in their craft, it sank, proving once and for all that you can't have your kayak and heat it.
That actually is quite good. I quite like that one.
All right, I'll just find them all then. No, send me more. Yeah. I'm lazy.
You need to moan on the Slack channel. The people in Slack are a lot more responsive to the podcast listeners.
I'm
disappointed with the podcast listeners, if I'm honest. They're a disappointing bunch. but if you want to prove me wrong, see, I'm using reverse psychology there, Marcus. Yeah. I know, they'll never get it. They never realise that's what I'm doing. If you want to prove me wrong, you send an email to marcus@boagworld.com. Prove to me that podcast listeners are better than Slack listeners. There we go. So that's it for this week's show. I think that about covers everything. If don't forget to join us next week, where we'll be talking to IBM and what's going on there, which is very exciting. But until then, thanks for listening and goodbye.
Bye.